Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Poetry for Everyone, Old Favorites, New Vision. Our presenter is Paul Olson. Session number OLP 2006-2. Let's listen in.
And I'm a teaching staff coordinator this summer. And I'm also, in another life, an English teacher and a track coach. And those two things seemingly don't fit together, but if you want to talk to me how they do, I'll talk to you later. We'll just talk English tonight. I think one of the great things about Holden is that in lots of different disciplines, we learn about new paradigms. We learn to think with a different sense of things. This week, as you look at all of the sessions that will be posted, I think, sometime after Vespers, you'll see that there are lots of opportunities to look at the world, whether it's economics or corporate ethics or how we read the Bible, a lot of different aspects throughout. All the sessions are looked at sometimes with different eyes. That's what these poems are about, and that's what I'll share with you, a way to go through that, those different eyes with some poets. As an educator, one of the stories I've gotten a lot of mileage out of, so some of you might have heard it. It's a very popular story, but it's worth hearing again and again and again, I think. And the story is simply this guy is walking along the edge of a cliff on a very beautiful day, and he's just so absorbed in everything that's around him. Off to his left are mountains like Buckskin and name all the mountains around us in the valley, and they're snow-capped, and it's just a spectacular view. And off to his right, straight down off a cliff, 500 feet, is this pristine valley, and there's a river flowing through it. And he's all absorbed in his surroundings, and he falls off the cliff. 500 feet straight down. But halfway down, there's a branch. He grabs the branch. He's hanging on to this thing for dear life. And 200 feet down, 300 feet up, and he calls, "Help, help, can anybody help me?" And a voice rumbles out of the clouds, "Yes, I can help you. Who are you?" "I am God." "Are you sure you can help me?" "I can help you." "What do I have to do?" "Let go." "Is there anybody else up there?" And for me, it's my favorite illustration of both theological and educational. If he could let go of the most secure thing in his life, he could come to God. But he's not going to. He's going to hang on to this branch because it's safe. Robert Frost talks about that. I think some sessions coming up, I'll push those right now, with Peter and Verlan looking at the Bible, are going to talk about how can we let go of our branch and our secure ways of, come on in. Somebody will have poems to share with you. Can we look at things differently? So enough of introduction. We'll go right to Robert Frost. I promised on the kiosk that it would be a new look at an old poem. It's old enough. How many people have seen this before? I'm assuming almost everybody. Well, what made it famous? Does anybody know that? Yeah, that's it. Good fences make good neighbors. And that line, that's a great answer. I hadn't even thought of that. That line is so famous, good fences make good neighbors, makes it famous. And then there's an event. Robert Frost read this. Where would be a crazy place to read it? Like in about 1975. The Berlin Wall. And then John Kennedy, quoted just a line from this there too. Okay, here we go. I'll read, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read the whole thing through at the end. But just now we're going to look at line by line quickly and see what kind of a sense you get of things, and I'll be your recording secretary and write that down as we go. Okay. "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast." Just literally, what are the images that are there? And I'm going to put them down for you. We've got, what? Something doesn't love a wall, sends the groundswell under it, and what happens? We've got these boulders, okay? And they're different shapes, and, okay. They're the wall. And what happens in the spring?
Thaw.
Thaw. And they tumble down, right? And what is it? Something doesn't like that wall. We don't know what it is yet, but something keeps making these rocks tumble down. And can you imagine New England or England? And you've seen those stone fences that weave their way through. Okay, that's our picture. And it spills these boulders. They're just the ones on the top that are so big that two people could pass abreast there. Everybody's got the picture?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's how we teach poetry. We just draw pictures. And, hi, diddle, diddle, a cat. That's really a fun one to draw. And then he starts to speculate, well, the work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. Why? What's that? What's happening there? Just literally.
They're taking the
fence. Yeah, to get to get at the rabbit. So the dog. Okay, good. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. Now, I'll act like an English teacher for a second. Even the rhythm, right? Mm-hmm. We meet. And so, but literally again, what's happening?
Repairing.
And how are they doing that? We've got the wall right here.
Each on
opposite sides. And, okay, we'll come back to that. Good. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. That's good. Laughter is good. And that's kind of a weird thing, isn't it? So what does that mean to you? You know, we're working hard. We're picking up these boulders. We're putting them up. Stay where you are, and our backs are turned. What? What?
They're falling
again, and?
We're building them back up again.
But they're going to, what are they going to do? Are they going to turn around and fix them?
No,
they're going to keep going. And what do you think about that?
Are they really serious about it, or is it just an exercise?
Great answer. Are they really serious, or is this just an exercise?
It's a good way.
What?
Good way for neighbors to meet.
It's a good way for neighbors to meet. It is, and that's a good reading of this. Pardon me?
A new project together.
A new project, yeah, to do a project together, and so we don't care. We're just, but we're going to see how neighborly they are as they do this, too. Okay, so we'll hear again. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why? Do they make good neighbors? And I'm going to, before I go on, what would be your answer to that common question? Well, we've got this fence, and this guy says good fences make good neighbors. Why? They're doing a project together, but in our own imagination, why do we have fences? Yeah.
It says what's mine and what's yours.
And it keeps us, you know, to our own and to ourselves, and yeah. And how many people have fence in their yard? Lots of us, okay. And what do you see as the purpose in that fence?
Privacy.
Keep the dogs out.
Keep the dogs out.
Or in.
Yeah.
Show the property line, you know, if you want to sell or whatever.
Yeah, well, for sure. We put them all on the property line.
Yeah.
And so now, what do you make of that? We put up fences to keep dogs in, to keep dogs out, keep kids out of swimming pool areas, and to show the property line. What do you
barriers.
Think about
pardon,
what?
Barriers.
So we've got some different words going here now. Barriers.
Boundaries.
Boundaries.
Ownership.
Define the space.
Define space.
Safety.
Protection,
yeah. Protection.
Protection.
Reaffirmation of a common understanding.
How do you spell all that?
I don't know.
Reaffirmation of a common, these guys sure have that, a common understanding.
And we are territorial.
How much room you have?
Say again?
How much room you have on your blackboard?
Well, I just write on the walls, doesn't matter. I keep going. I got a lot of room. You got another idea?
Privacy.
Privacy. Anything
I
else?
Just put up fences for my flowers. I mean, I'm not doing it to protect my property or anything. It's for my flowers.
To To shade them or to, so they climb them?
Yes, they have a place where I can...
A place what? Go ahead, I'm interested in this. A place where they can feel comfortable? That's why all the flowers in the mountains are dying. There are no fences. To, how do you spell? I can't spell that word right there. Whatever? All right, whatever. Huh?
Aesthetics.
Okay.
It's pretty.
It's also glam.
Aesthetics. Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Integrity.
In what?
Integrity.
Run with that a little bit.
The definition of a space and the integrity of that space is maintained by the boundary.
But it's there. Boundaries and barriers. You can find space. Define space.
Integrity of space. Gotcha. I've got to get rid of my great artwork here. If you guys want me to draw fences for you after, I can do that. Well, now, just put all those words together. What do you see? Territorial protection, barriers, boundaries, defined space, safety, reaffirmation, privacy. Good fences make good neighbors.
Not necessarily.
Doesn't sound like it, does it?
It's kind of a strange thing to do, to make good neighbors, isn't it? Why don't we drink a cup of coffee together, have a beer? Come on over and let's...
But, you know, by all those definitions, this fence is a terrible fence. This is not a good fence, by those definitions.
Because it's fallen apart? Maybe?
It's fallen apart, and they, even if they've set it back up, they just turn around and walk away. They don't try to make it... They don't. It doesn't say, you know, we put little rocks in to hold the big rocks up or anything like that. They just put it up, walk away, wish it didn't fall down, but it falls down. They don't care.
They don't care as long as their backs are turned.
It's not performing any of those tasks that we just listed.
It is reaffirming their common understanding.
Yeah, and their common understanding is it's springtime and we do this. It's written. Now we're going to, that's another category. Green pen. This becomes ritual.
Green little
pen. That pen's no good.
Don't hit
use that
Peter.
Purple one.
That's Peter. What I said over here.
Peter teaches at Wartburg. I can hit guys from Wartburg.
But you can't beat us.
No, I can't. Oh, he said, but you can't beat us. Boom! Boy, is that a deep wound.
We'll be in track.
Yeah, no, we can beat him in track. Well, we'll keep going. And we're going to see how all this comes together and try to look at what these characters do and what they say, and we'll just continue. So Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense.
Ooh.
Ouch.
Play on words.
What?
Yeah. Offense.
Offense.
Yeah, I got it, yeah. Very good. Well, what do you make of... who's doing all the questions? Go ahead.
What comes to do with why you're doing this? What is your motivation? Are you trying to protect your neighbors from your dog that might offend them by going over and doing something in their yard that they wouldn't like? Or because you don't want something of your neighbors infringing upon yours? Is it selfless or selfish?
Yeah.
For which you are building the fence.
That's very good. And so we'll have to explore what these guys, is what seems to be their motivation. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. Maybe it's just this chance to be together. And it's a great observation, and let's see what we do with that as he finishes up his kind of criticism, isn't he? But, you know, I'd like to, who's the smart guy here? You know, before I build a wall, I'd like to, you know, why do they make, I'd like to put a notion in his head. Hey, you, neighbor, why? Why do they make good neighbors? And let's think about this, neighbor. I mean, who's is it kind of condescending? Hey, think about this. We don't have cows. And my cows aren't, you know, my apples won't get over to eat here. We said that already.
It sounds like neither of them built the fence. Maybe the fence was there and they're maintaining their tradition.
Wow. So we got Jane's word ritual. Now we're going to add tradition. Got a lot of traditions that we hang on to, and that's why that story at the beginning, right? These secure traditions. And these guys have this, and they're not going to let it go, in spite of their consciousness that this is really kind of silly. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. Yeah. Go ahead.
Would it be more work to tear down the whole wall than to just mend the little pieces?
I would think for sure
I mean, if we're looking at it like just kind of purely kind of from an outside view, then maybe just aesthetically they'd rather just fix the wall than...
Yeah, then tear it down.
Then tear it down. It'll take a lot of time.
Simon's been to several sessions with me, and I've told him this 12 times. I have an application blank for Augustana with me. That kid's going to, he's been so, you know, what is it called, subliminal advertising? I have not been subliminal at all. You got it. Okay. Yeah, and we got to, maybe that's part of it too, that kind of reinforces the notion of this is an aesthetic exercise. We're going to keep it, okay, I like that. Well, we've got that line, before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is, it doesn't love a wall. It wants it down. I mean, what is it? I mean, he doesn't know, does he? But what happens every spring? It's down. And maybe it's frost. Maybe it's hunters that come by. Maybe, and then he speculates, even crazier. It's not, I could say, I know what it does. It's not the frost. It's not the hunters. Shh. It's elves. Okay, class is dismissed. We got it figured out. It's elves. But it's not elves exactly. And I'd rather he said it for himself. Can't you see? I mean, he's saying to him, right? How do you... This is your neighbor that started all this and is saying this stuff to you. Nice guy? Your buddy? Is he... Do you feel condescended to? Do you? It's elves. I'd rather you said it for yourself, you dummy. That's not in there. Is that a sensible interpretation of that? I want you to realize what it is. And I wish you knew, because I do. I could tell you, right? But, well, we'll continue. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly. I'd rather he said it for himself. And then watch this. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me. Any thoughts?
Who's he doesn't think. He doesn't question. He just acts.
The neighbor. Not the speaker, but the neighbor. The neighbor. Yeah. He moves in darkness. When is this guy going to see the light? Okay. And what do you do with how do you feel about this, like an old stone savage armed, you know, it's kind of a uncivilized, and how hard have they worked at this? You remember, without looking back?
Not very.
Well,
they did.
But their hands are worn rough. This is not an easy task. And they're sticking to this, I love your two words so far, ritual and tradition. Wearing out their hands, even though it's the stupidest thing, to stay there you are, and there seems to be no practical reason for this. Cows don't eat, and apples don't eat pine cones. Well, we're going to continue. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He lives in the dark, and not just because it's more than that. And he criticizes him, I think. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Any thoughts?
His father made the wall.
What?
His father made the wall. The neighbor's father.
Sure, okay. So I'll put down, that's what we've always done. And I would encourage you as you go through the week, think about how we read the Bible. That's what we've always done. And it's pretty hard to let go of that. That's how, you know, we drive. You'll feel like with forums and class sessions all week long, you're going to have a chance to look at our traditions, our rituals, and the things that we've always done. And Holden, if you do it twice, we say that's how it's always been done. But those guys who've been here lots of years know different. Well, any other thoughts on this poem? We're not done yet. But anything else that you see that...
Just I noticed that after all of this, looking back, it was the speaker who reminded the neighbor it was time to do this.
Great point. Who initiated all this?
The speaker, who's always done it this way.
and who thinks he's, you know, I know, this is just stupid, but it's a great point. It's probably the heart of the poem. Who initiates this whole thing? The guy who says, let's not do this, or I don't know why we're doing it. I wish you would see the reasons. I wish you'd understand that it's not elves, it's something else. But by the way, we're going to do this. What does that say about tradition and ritual and the way we've always done it? I don't know if it's a good analogy, but I've driven an SUV for a lot of years because I have a boat. And the boat is a big deal to me. I take it up the Mississippi River. It's a little boat, but I take it up the Mississippi River, and I come down, and I bike all day, and I sleep on the floor of the boat, and I move a little bit farther down. It's a spiritual journey. And I've argued for, Jeannie will tell, my wife will tell me, for lots of years, I got to have an SUV to pull my boat. Because I couldn't even see it another way. And then I bought a little four-cylinder Honda, and guess what?
You can pull your boat.
It pulls my boat.
No, I pulled a boat in my Honda.
But she's got a Honda too, and we also thought that wouldn't work. Yeah. So just for a second, go ahead.
You just reenacted the poem right there. That's exactly the poem. You know, it's sort of about self and other.
Yeah.
And how Cross defines himself against this farmer.
Yes.
And the point
yes.
is that he's enlightened. He's sort of teasing around with all of this, you know, with this let's don't mend the wall, but
yep.
then he calls it in, and then he
yep.
gets to say the other. So you've got the Honda, and you've got the SUV, and
yep.
you've got the boat.
Yeah.
It's just a reenactment of,
that's good.
of what's going on.
Okay, we're done with that. We reenacted the thing. We made it a play. Well, more comments about Mike.
I think one of the ironies of his poem is that what's, for many people, what they know it for most is that it's a kind of a conventional wisdom or wisdom of the good friends and the good neighbors, and without a sense that it's, that he's at the same time critiquing it.
Yes, so that's a great, I would put that down too. Conventional wisdom. Just for the fun of it, think of rituals, traditions, that's what we've always done, conventional wisdom that we live by. And that are our branches hanging from the cliff. And we're not going to let go of those.
Oh, do you know if Robert Frost made the line, good fences make good neighbors, or was that around before this poem was written?
I don't know.
Well, if it was, then it really...
And forget about coming to Augustana. I don't know. Kids that ask questions I can't answer, die.
I think it really says something about kind of society that if it was written by him, that line is taken out of the poem, completely out of context, and used as a convention, as a piece of conventional wisdom.
And that's a great point, and that's exactly what his neighbor does.
It's exactly like the
so
poem.
It's almost moot whether Frost caught it, thought of it or not, but that's a great, you raise a great point. Okay, you're back in. anybody else? Let's just run with this a little bit. Tradition, conventional wisdom. Okay, sorry.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the practicality of the fence is that it keeps us from the terror of an open boundary. So that, you know, we don't have to approach that kind of vague point. We don't know really where I start and someone else begins. Am I invading them and are they invading me? What do I do when that happens?
What does America do when that happens? What are we doing right now? You know, build a 50-foot wall so that somebody else can build a 50-foot, 51-foot ladder. Yeah, that's a great point. And that's what I'm after, I guess, is to think of examples in our lives, whether it's culturally, socially, individually, in relationship, whatever. But this is the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom, we want to have clear boundaries. We can get really philosophical, and someday maybe we can do that in a conversation outside of here. Of a humankind struggle for certainties and absolutes. And I'm going to hang on to my absolute no matter what. And we've got absolutes about sexuality, we've got absolutes about race, we've got absolutes, and it can go on and on and on and on. And I think Frost is surely aware of that. I mean, this poet, his vehicle is this fence and these two guys. But the vehicle carries a big load. And you guys have pointed out what that load is. It's all of this that we have to give question to. And what kind of absolutes do human beings cling to so that we can have our boundaries and we can have our defined space and we can be safe? I'll throw out another line that has nothing to do with Robert Frost, but it has everything to do with Robert Frost. It's John Keats, 2 centuries before, who in praise of Shakespeare says about him, Shakespeare alone, now we can think about this of anybody that can be this, he calls it the admirable man in 17th century or 18th century language. Shakespeare alone can live in uncertainty, mystery, and doubt without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. We want to have facts, and we want to have reasons, and my wife can tell you stories all day long about, as a hospital chaplain, how people come in and why did this happen? I got to know. How do we read the Bible? I got to know. Job does it. On and on it goes. Anybody else have comments about, yes?
It reminds me a little of my five-year-old who started asking just tons of questions. She's categorizing her world. Is he a good guy or a bad guy? And she's really interested in cars, and I commented that I love my car because it really powers up the hills.
The Povo.
It's a four-cylinder. It's got a good get up and go. Anyway, and I commented I love my car, and later she said, weeks later she says, why do people love their cars? What is it about a car that somebody would love? And it just categorizing everything. Yeah. It's so primal in us that we have to have everything in boxes
with labels.
Yes, well labeled.
One of the, go ahead, Bernard.
I was going to say it. The thing about boundaries, if you have to at least know them, because if you don't know them, it's offensive not to know them.
Right. There are certain. Yeah.
Can you take that one step further? They're fundamental to community. Boundaries are fundamental to community because what we define as community is us as set against others. It's us,
Yeah.
And even coming here a couple of days ago, there are rituals and traditions that when you come to Holden for the first time, you're exposed to. And there are things like ice cream after a chapel, right? I mean, that's tradition.
That's a branch we're all hanging on to.
I think the boundaries are not something that we can. I mean, I think it would be really difficult for community to dissolve all of the boundaries because then it would be. I don't know how you would define your community.
Yeah.
If you had no boundaries whatsoever, I mean, how do we know we're Lutherans?
So we're wondering now. You raise a question that all of a sudden boundaries are good and boundaries are bad, and borders are good and borders are bad, and who can live in uncertainty, mystery, and doubt? I want to get this clear. We're going to establish this bound. And you raise it. You complicate it as it should be complicated. Eunice.
In the context of this poem, they wouldn't meet if there weren't a wall to walk.
Yep.
And the humor that the two of them can say together, stay where you are until our backs are turned. I mean, we can laugh at that, but it's rare that two neighbors are going to have the same whimsical approach, it seems. So they communicate because of having this job to do, whether or not it's of urgent necessity.
Yep.
We just left it.
Maybe the problem, Paul, is with unexamined traditions. Okay? Because traditions are absolutely important. And of course, what do we hang on to ultimately is God himself. And there's good reasons for doing that. So part of it, maybe just wanted them to ask and say, well, why are we doing that? I say, well, hey, we've always done it. What the heck? It looks nice. Let's do it. But at least they thought about it and decided, I kind of enjoy doing it. It's good physical labor, good workout. I like putting the fence back. I'd rather have it been than a pile of rubble here. So, but if you think about it, you say, yeah, this is a tradition. We're doing it. We don't need to have a fence here. Let's do it. What the heck? Or it's Christmas time and we always put this up here because we like it that way.
Yeah. Do you think, that's an insightful remark, and all you've said is great. Do you think that this is a criticism of traditions? And talk about examining. And doesn't all, we'll look at another one in a second, we better get to it. Doesn't all literature take us on this journey, Richard Wright calls it the shores of knowing, this rise in consciousness of examining the wall, and maybe after it's examined, that's where we stay. These guys stay, obviously they're gonna, right? So we've got this human journey through, I would argue that it's through all literature, that takes us through this rise in consciousness without which we remain Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. I mean, we can't live in the wilderness where there's questions and doubt and mystery. And, yeah.
The way I see it, I don't even know if Robert Frost is really just talking about two people mending a fence.
Oh, good.
And I think that more so he's talking about just human relations in general, and the fact that the desire to have boundaries offsets and kind of overpowers the desire to make relationships that are positive
sure.
for people.
Sure.
And it seems really present. I don't know when he was writing it. It was early
1930s,
40s. I wonder if it was anything to do with World War II and the idea of kind of an overwhelming sense of desire for protection during that kind of time.
I'll add another word here out of your statements there
to
boundaries. I'm just going to call it nationalism. And then let's go to the next poem. And you raised a great point, Simon. Be sure you get the application right. The context of this poem is Wendell Berry is really become an American icon, I think, for lots of people. And if he isn't, check him out. He might be your icon. He's been looking, literally, at some photographs in a magazine during the Cold War about folks in Russia. And thus, he writes this poem to a Siberian woodsman after looking at some pictures. I'm going to highlight a line. I won't stop and I'm going to read it straight through. Let's see. Sorry about this. I don't have it highlighted. I'm not going to waste any more time. I'll come to it. Here we go. He's imagining this Siberian woodsman in the context of a family a lot like his. You lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest, the cry of the saw in your head, and the vision of coming home to rest. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music. Her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you, as your hands work, is the dream of the still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. I have thought of you, stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. You go in under the overarching green branches of the forest whose ways, strange to me, are well known to you as the sound of your own voice, or the silence that lies around you now that you have ceased to speak. And soon the voice of the stream rises ahead of you, and you take the path beside it. I have thought of the sun breaking pale through the mists over you as you come to the pool where you will fish, and of the mist drifting over the water, and of the cast fly resting light on the face of the pool. And I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words as the wren's song is its song. Who has invented our enmity? I'm going to stop this for a second. And you know exactly what he's doing, right? And the enmity, it isn't all the ambiguity you presented about Robert Frost is really insightful and good. We also know that something creates this enmity, and now he's bringing the same kind of question. Where does this come from? This tradition, that's what we've always done, grew up to hate the Russians. I grew up so afraid of them because my dad, every night, used to sit on the top of the school in 1950s looking for airplanes in northern Minnesota because that's how we were. Anybody else go through that? We were going to be attacked. And that's what they did in small northern Minnesota towns. The attack was going to come from, Eunice did. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who is on, by the way, my dad was crazy. The whole town did it. The whole town did it. Okay. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house and the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such anger to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of birds? Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me. We don't have to think long about American history and all of its divisions to find our concrete illustrations of this. Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you, or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I've seen these pictures of your face? Now we're going past the political, right? What do you feel, that was the line I was going to have, about that line in itself? Who can consider your death negligible now that I've seen pictures of your face? What makes someone's death negligible?
You know what?
Impersonal.
Impersonal.
They're an object.
You don't know. They're an object. And these objects are created by something, and now it's the examined life. Who has done this? And who am I supporting? Will we continue? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And now one of the ideas of my place will be that you would gladly talk and visit and work with me. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native. And I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I'm going to stop. Any thoughts? Do borders, does his country matter to him?
Sounds like it.
Sure. And is it define him? Are his borders good to him? Run that line by you again. I sit in the shade of trees. They are native. I am native. I hold to this place. This is who he is, no? But, well, we'll continue. And then here are these powerful images. And anybody else, I'm going to look out at you just for a second after each line. If you've got a thought, a response to these images, share it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore. Or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut. Nor has the elm bowed before monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. Any thoughts?
The land exists far before any nationality.
Yeah.
Or outside of any nationality. It's almost nationality is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Good. Natural boundaries, and if you ask geographers, why do we build on either side of a river, and why is the river divides our states, and instead of all kinds of boundaries shape us, but then they begin to define us, and they begin then to limit us, and we become nation states, and then we look at South Africa and Namibia, and we look at Palestine and Israel, and we look across the world, and see. All of these natural things are contradictory to the establishment of nation states. Well, in the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that I have borne on my back like a hump. And in the thought of myself, I imagine you free of weapons and official hates, so that if we should meet, we would not go by each other looking at the ground like slaves sullen under their burdens, but would stand clear in the gaze of each other. There is no government so worthy as your son who fishes with you in silence beside the forest pool. There is no national glory so comely as your daughter whose hands have learned the music and go their own way on the keys. There is no national glory so comely as my daughter who dances and sings and is the brightness of my house. There is no government so worthy as my son who laughs as he comes up the path from the river in the evening for joy. We got a while. Any thoughts about, let's just look at his images very quickly and see where they take us. You tell me what they are, but without looking back, the images that you remember most. Don't even look back at the poem. You remember something that struck you and it's going to be in your brain. And then what is the image that carried that? That's the theme, and that's really good. The
international trees.
Okay, so we got sycamore. And we got?
Walnut
trees. What?
Elm.
The elm tree? I heard another one.
Wren songs.
The wren songs.
devotion of the family.
Okay, then that's thematic, and so these are the images, and promotion of family. Oof, I'll put it down.
Girls and music.
Dancing
and singing.
So we've got piano keys.
Accordion.
And accordion. Everybody's American favorite into this room. you're on to it. The images carry the load.
The image of the decrees written on these.
On these?
Yeah. Well, the one person said that there are no decrees written. There's no decrees written on these. No flags. No flying pins.
Ooh, flags.
Decrees.
Flags. Borders, nations, states.
Bowing to monuments.
What?
Bowing to monuments. It says no bowing, but not.
Yeah, okay. Another image. Yeah, monuments. Geographers also use the phrase, can we struggle between the private rights and the public good? And what tradition do we cling to? It's my right to, let me fill in the blank. It's my right to take the water out of this river, and Texas is fighting over the Rio Grande. And you Washingtonians and Oregonians know what's everybody fighting over here? The Columbia River, right? You know, who's going to get it? The farmers, the salmon fishers, fisheries.
Breaching the dams.
What?
Breaching the dams.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't the whole thing seem to revolve around relationships, whether it's personal or familial, or environmental? I mean, that we can't afford to build walls, we have to learn to build bridges.
So that's a great insight. What are the traditions and the branches, to go back to the very first story, that we, for the most part, base our relationships on? What are the things that we say, you know, I'm going to stick to
nationalism?
So we've got, yeah, your nationality.
Race. Gender.
We're going places.
I think he's really set up three relationships in here. One is all individuals with nature. Another is individuals among themselves on a human level. And then individuals among themselves on an official governmental level. And all, he's got it all woven in together.
He does. It's good. And what's natural and...
Mm-hmm. The thing that comes to me is the sameness of both places. I mean, he's obviously describing a fishing pool that he imagines the Siberian woodsman to have, because
yeah,
he knows his fishing pool.
Good.
And he imagines the children are the same, you know, they like the same kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that the land is similar, there are similar aspects to forests that they both share. And I was thinking a lot of the song that we sing here on the 4th of July, the hymn that says, you know, my fields are green and the skies are blue, and talks about this love of country, but then says, but other places have green fields too, and we share the same blue skies, and that kind of relationship of knowing that there's similarities and knowing that there's love of land and love of family in both places.
Yeah, that's very good.
I'm really struck by the distinction in the two poems in that Frost walks with his neighbor and sets the boundaries between the two neighbors. And Barry's poem is about two men who have been forbidden to speak to each other.
Yeah.
And somebody else set the boundaries for them.
And somebody else set the boundary. That's a great comment. And based on
nationalism.
And yeah, and you can go through all kinds
based
of things.
Fear.
And
fear.
And where's the examined? What?
Based on fear.
And fear, sure. So if we don't base relationships, whether it's with nature, with our fellow human beings, or with my land, that as Barry describes it, that has defined him, what's another way to base relationships? Or do we just let that go, and that's not in the poem? And the poem instead asks us to examine this human journey, which is pretty much spelled out for us by our traditions and the words we had up here before. There's a very important African-American writer, Richard Wright, who you've all probably heard of, writes a lot of stuff about the unnaturalness of life in the city. And when characters try to live naturally, they almost always die because they can't survive living outside of the borders that have been established, whether it's a red line district in the housing area or it's getting certain jobs or being refused from jobs. My point in bringing that up is not to talk about right, but to ask you, what are the things that the branches we hold on to that are in, that come out of this poem that are going to prevent full human experience, whether that means love, hope, satisfaction and joy in life? What are the things that become the branches here? And just stick to the poem for a second. We've got a little while yet.
The official hates.
We are going to stick to, and then maybe it's helpful to see, one of the things that I think teaching literature is all about is to find out the universality of it. Does this speak to us just in 1940 around World War II, or when he speaks at the Berlin Wall, or does it speak to all of us all the time? So, what was your phrase again?
The official hates.
The official hates.
How he wishes that he could be without them.
Now, run with that, and I'm going to put some over in this other column. What are some of these official hates, or have they been, if you want to go to history or current? What are some?
Nazis.
But don't they change with what's happening to the world?
Oh, don't they ever? Yeah.
Your father, when he was up there, because in Anacortes they were shooting, things over there. So your father in Minnesota was up on the rooftop.
Yeah, Minnesota towns all over the country. So these official hates.
The enemy.
Do we want to have what?
The enemy or the scapegoat? So whoever deemed enemy the scapegoat.
Nationalism is an official hate. Fundamentalism.
Listen to him. Nationalism, fundamentalism that doesn't accept any other view but the.
Things you fear become things you hate because you don't know what to do about them.
Now, let's stop here. Be concrete. Not you, Bridget, but anybody. Be concrete with an official hate.
Terrorists.
What?
Terrorists.
Terrorists.
That's me.
Communists.
Right now.
Equal access.
And now be even more concrete than terrorists.
Islam. Okay.
Islam.
Islamic extremists. Not the good, happy Arabs.
And how often do you hear in our media the phrase Christian extremist?
Never.
That's an interesting thing to me. We don't hear that. Well, I know why. The terrorists, Islams, Arabs, extremists, keep going.
North Koreans. Well, not them, 30 years, I guess.
Well,
some people fear homosexuals.
There's no division.
Now we get to the whole notion. That's a branch that we cling to. James Baldwin has a wonderful phrase, the purpose of God is to make us larger, freer, and more loving. So all of this is kind of contrary to God. To take Baldwin's quote, larger, freer, and more loving, and most of us grab our branches that make us what? Smaller, larger, freer, less free, and surely hate-filled.
Oh.
French, I think often of that whole crazy thing when we stopped. I mean, I had a friend that wouldn't eat French fries back in the... Yeah. I mean, anybody do that? I'm not going to support those guys. If you call them... In fact, in Washington, they had a different name for them.
Freedom fries.
They really were invented in Belgium.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that, but I'm so relieved.
Now you went to it again, right?
Yeah, I saw a hand here. Somewhere.
Well, she was bringing up North Korea, and it struck me that a key thing is that it's never people in nature be in large groups so that you don't humanize the enemy. Because when you humanize the enemy, they can't be an official hate anymore. This poem. Then you know who they are and they're just like you.
Now that I've seen pictures of your face, who can consider your death negligible?
I think when you talk
talk about that too. I think of the photos that came back after, or at the time of Vietnam, of the little girl screaming, and or that wasn't Vietnam, was that the but also any pictures of the people affected by the bombs in Hiroshima too. And so, anytime we saw actual effects of that on people, then you know it's just exactly like the phrase: when you see their faces, it changes the story.
That's why it all has to be sanitized.
So. Now, and we'll end this, think of some of, go back to the very beginning, some of the branches we hold on to that are represented by the metaphor of the guy hanging on the branch. And I'm going to get you started with just the media. How is that a branch that we're going to cling to hold on to what we're secure with? Is that a question that makes any sense? Thank you for making it make sense.
I don't think a lot of us want to think for ourselves. We want somebody to tell us how it is and what we should think and make it all make sense and get it in a sound bite.
We want sound bites. We accept them, and we make our judgments on the basis of those. And when there's more complexity involved, can you help me? I can help you. What I got to do? Let go of the sound bite, and instead of reading or listening to Fox News, we got to look at Environment Magazine or Sojourner or whatever.
But before we even get to Fox News, that since at least the Reagan administration, the media has capitulated and hasn't gone after the story in most cases. The White House hands them the talking points. These are the things that they're allowed to talk about. These are the things they're allowed to cover if they will be inserted in a unit. So
embedded.
Yeah.
Isn't that a quaint term? In bed with.
Well, I think though. Very interesting. I mean, a big part of all of this is how we're looking at Scripture. Because, I mean, Scripture is all about nations, good nations, bad nations, good people, bad people, boundaries, tribalism, you know, on the face of it.
On the face of it, thank you.
And so, so it's very easy to go to Scripture and just say, well, you know, this is a pagan naturalist poem that you're reading us, and right here it says, you know, God likes the righteous nation and God hates the evil nation. And there you have it.
But who wrote it? Human perspective, right?
Well, it's
a particular humans too.
I mean, you have to look at how we deal with and relate to Scripture, but I'm just saying that It's a very, very powerful tool for all of these very negative things that we're talking about.
I would just encourage us as we end this to let all the literature you read, not only about the wall and not only about, it's clearly an anti-war poem and about a Russian peasant and a farmer in Kentucky, but the whole process of analysis, literary analysis, becomes a process of learning to understand how we get at truth. And we had to work at it a little bit, didn't we? We had to share ideas. I had to listen to you and to you, and we had to come together on this, and we counter each other, and we back and forth. And I think the process, the very process of doing any kind of literary analysis is a worth, non-violent English teacher, aren't I? Is a worthwhile exercise because it says something about the analysis of human behavior and how, as humans, we seek or don't seek to find truth. I'll leave you with a line from a slave narrative. The black slave says, in the face of lots of slave narratives written by white men, passed off as slaves to counter the whole abolitionist period, and there were lots of those going on in the 19th century, 'tis not he who looked on who can excuse me, who can describe slavery, but he who endured. And then that suggests going a whole other route to find out about the truth of slavery. Are we going to read these slave narratives in this venue, or are we going to look at some of these that are realistic and true? Is that an example that makes sense to you? So what we just did here, and what Frost asks us to do, I think, and what all poets ask us to do is look at this poem, let it be what it is for you, let it be not only about something, but it's an experience in itself that we just experienced the struggle with trying to find truth, didn't we? I mean, we all come, and that's a worthwhile thing, and it's the end of my sermon. Thank you. You're a wonderful group.